Good morning and welcome to a C-Suite Conversation with Andrew Eddington, COO, Gowling, WLG, and James Quinn, CEO of Claralis. My name is Bethann Stubbe. I am the Director of Publications and Press for ILTA. And today we're going to sit down to talk innovation with impact. There's a lot going on in drafting automation, and we want to talk about the pitfalls to avoid and how to measure success. We know that when it comes to complex legal matters and associated documentation, innovation with impact starts with a leadership mindset and is not restricted by legacy tech or perceptions. Success depends on the alignment of the right people, the right tech, and the clear and realistic processes needed. The foundation of trust between the tech provider and law firms underpins this approach. So let's make sure you are not trying to fix the wrong problem. And let's make sure that our ILTA members are confident that you and your firm or your product or service will overcome any resistance to change with a proven technology and a proven methodology. Gowling WLG understands the importance of being in tune with their clients' world, which requires agility to enable alignment with opportunities in the market. Claralis is a market leader in the deep automation of complex legal tech drafting, with industry-leading legal tech and lawyer-led managed services. The Claralis team works with leading law firms globally. In this podcast, we sit down with these two gentlemen to share insights on how to achieve operational excellence when it comes to the automation of complex documentation, overcome resistance to change, and to harness innovation that has the most significant impact on both clients and attorneys. This impact can be measured in terms of increased productivity, efficiency, risk reduction, competitive advantages, and lawyer-enabled well-being. Simply, we want a greater capacity within teams at the senior level to focus on high-value strategic work and to make life a little bit more easy for everyone. I'm very excited to sit down with both Andrew Eddington, COO of Gowling WLG, and James Quinn, CEO of Claralis. Here we go. Gentlemen, welcome.
So the first question, Andrew, I had was, what's your general approach to innovation at the firm?
We try and structure our approach around innovation around three key pillars, really. Just in headline terms, the first one is we try and keep innovation as simple and straightforward as possible, which makes them more engageable for most people in the firm. The second one is that we empower people to innovate. So looking at their own roles and their own client issues locally and where they can do that without necessarily falling back to technology all of the time. And that might be a theme we touch on through this podcast. And the third one that's really important actually is that the innovation is led from the top and really has a really visible sponsorship right from the top of the organization. And we find it's much harder to ask our lawyers and partners to do these things if the people at the top aren't showing that they're really important. So those are the three pillars that sort of guide us through innovation within Gowlings. It'd be quite interesting to hear about when you think a firm's ready to start adopting drafting automation.
I'd say that there's a gold standard here, which I'm sure most of us don't reach, but that would be totally centralized knowledge management. So specifically centralized management of model forms of precedents and other templates. But for those firms that don't have that, and it's not necessary firm-wide, it's if a given department or area of work has settled precedents or there's a settled suite of precedents that you work on for a particular client, then that can be the basis. But the basic message is that you can't have document automation unless you've got something to automate. And so having those settled forms of documents is really a precursor to automation. And certainly we wouldn't advocate a blanket approach here in that you should be targeting individual use cases and evaluating those to see whether there's a return on investment for the technology. Going to automate the whole firm shouldn't really be a goal for anybody because there's only going to be certain use cases which are worth investing in and others definitely won't be. So I suppose once you've identified that you might have a use case for automation and then determining whether you're ready for automation, it's just about spending the time and really concentrating on whether that's going to give you a return on investment. So first project's absolutely key here in that if you get your first project wrong, then the technology is not going to have the right reputation internally and you're going to find it difficult. If somebody's coming to you, for example, and asking for some more money for a particular project and the last one didn't give you a return on investment, then you're likely to give them a flat no. So when you're evaluating the ROI, so the just basics, so the potential benefit against the cost, then how much time are you anticipating that you'll save through use of this technology? How often are you drafting the particular documents and whose time you're saving is often forgotten. So it's not the same, obviously, if you're saving partner time versus a paralegal, they have a different value per hour to the organization. So going through those is important. And then evaluating that against the license fee, of course, but also the resourcing that you're going to require internally, and that's certainly something which is grossly underestimated as standard. Your implementation, your testing, which can, depending on the method of implementation, can be significant, and your maintenance. So if you get through all of that and you can't see a clear return on investment, then I'd say you're not ready, in that you don't have the appropriate use case. And it's really important that you do wait until you have that appropriate use case, because that's when you're going to get your first project, which is going to be successful for the firm. And then somebody can come to you, Andrew, and say, can we do another one of those? And you will say, absolutely, let's do it. But it's really important to get the first few right. So a bit of a lengthy answer there. but I suppose in all of this, and in the evaluation, you've got to make sure that knowledge management and innovation are completely aligned internally. So how do you ensure that alignment happens within Gallings?
I think it's building on the points you've just made, actually, about making sure that you've got a really strong use case. I think it's really easy, isn't it, to automate something just for the sake of automating it. And our knowledge team works really, really closely with our innovation team, actually, to try and avoid that as often as we can. I'm not sure we get it right every time, but we try and get it right most of the time. So they literally work side by side testing the use cases that are put forward to make sure we understand the benefits that would have for either our clients, most importantly, or for us, and our legal teams secondary. And then we try and focus on those cases, and the teams work together to develop them. The point about maintenance really resonates strongly, actually. I think that's probably one we've learned through our experience, that you have to think about who will own and maintain the automation once it's delivered very early. So that that's part of your planning. And for us, the knowledge management team tend to own the ongoing maintenance of the precedents once they've been automated, if that makes sense. The other thing those two teams do together, actually, is once we think we've got the right use case, by talking to either our clients or listening to what our legal teams are saying, we go and then test that with the data that we have within our business and say, you know, is the data telling us the same thing as our clients are telling us, or our lawyers are telling us about where the biggest opportunity is? And if we can get all of those things to line up with them, generally speaking, we think we've got a good use case. What we try and avoid, to your point, actually, with the knowledge management team and the innovation team as they're doing this work, is finding we've got, you know, a really good hammer of document automation and then going looking for nails to hit with it. You know, that's the one thing we work really hard. And I think everybody knows that analogy, but it's amazing how many times I see people wandering around organizations with the hammer in their hand saying, you know, I know about the hammer analogy, but I'm still going to go and do it. So I think it's looking out for those things.
In identifying those problems to solve, as it were, so that you're not running around with your hammer, do you have a formal process for that? How do you go about identifying the right problems to solve?
Yeah, we do actually have a sort of a methodology around this, and it's not complicated, actually. It starts with going and asking intelligent questions and, importantly, listening. And we talk to our clients as well as our own legal teams when we're trying to find those use cases. So to bring that to life a bit, one of the things we do with our clients is we run sessions that we call GC Labs, where we'll spend an afternoon with the general counsel at one of our clients, just listening to the problems that they're dealing with, and then with our innovation team trying to come up with suggestions about how they might develop solutions to those pain points. That's one area that we work with in quite a structured way. We also spend a lot of time talking to our legal teams about the things that get in the way of them delivering efficiently, really, which leads us normally to the documents that are the most valuable use cases to automate. But again, it does come back to combining all of that intelligence you can gather through feedback and anecdote and by listening with the evidence that the data in the business is giving us as well, and trying to find where both of those things are saying the same thing.
At the associate level, I suppose it's really important that everybody knows that they're listened to within the organisation as well, and it's not imposed.
It's hugely important, you know, and I've certainly seen in previous lives outside of legal examples of where you go and generate a lot of ideas for improvement around things like document automation by talking to, in this case, lawyers, and then don't deliver on them. And I think it's really important if you spend time listening to the client's perspective or the lawyer perspective, you're then very clear as an innovation team about the things that you can achieve, and you go and make them happen rather than setting expectations that you can solve everything. Because unfortunately, you know, with constraints around time and investment, solving everything isn't possible. So I think there is being really realistic about what can be achieved is important as well.
Sounds like a great process. I mean, if we were to focus in then on drafting or document automation, where have you guys found problems that are right to solve for you and had some success?
You know, we've been working on document automation for quite a while now with people like Clarilis. So we would consider ourselves to be relatively mature in this space. And we spent a lot of time listening to the clients and the legal teams about the problems. One of the things that I think we've learned through our journey, as well as having the right use case, is the importance of managing the change carefully. into the legal teams if you want to get adoption of the automated documents that are put in place. That can be a real challenge, actually. And we have a very simple methodology for this, which isn't particularly clever in any particular way. Actually, it's the value in it is in its simplicity. So the problem you're trying to fix is a problem that they recognize is a problem for them, if that makes sense. I think too often these projects start with solving problems that people in innovation teams think are important, but not necessarily that they've checked are really important to the client or to the legal team. The second part of our methodology then is being really, really clear on the solution and why that solution solves the problem. And the important bit here is how that solution makes things better for the person in the legal team or our client. Because again, often I've seen solutions deployed that make things, you know, fantastic for IT teams or innovation teams. But the lawyers are sitting there saying, crikey, that just feels like I've got a lot of extra work to do. How's that helping me? So getting that narrative clear is really, really important. And the third part then is giving the people that you're asking to adopt the change real confidence that the plan you've got will get them successfully from the problem to the new solution. And so they feel as though they can buy into that and come on the journey with you. And we focus a lot of time actually on the change management around this, probably as much, if not more time on this than we do on actually finding the right.
As you know, we work with your PSL team, so those in knowledge, but also in innovation as well, to make sure that we're building confidence along the process so that when we get to launch, that internally all the stakeholders can say, this stuff really works, we can recommend that you use it, and you're working with documents in Word at the moment, this is much faster, and so therefore you should be using Clarilus or whatever document automation system. And so that's really important to us to combat resistance, in that you need the internal seal of approval, and then especially from C-suite as well, that's the ultimate that you can get, that we've gone through the process and it's approved from the top, and so everyone should be using the technology. Exposing, getting people to come to a familiarization session. So we run training for Clarilus, and it's not because people don't know how to use a questionnaire online, because they do. It's just a bit of demystifying. So if we can get them in front of the technology and say, look, it's intuitive, easy to use. You know, if you can order something off Amazon, then you can use this technology, and it's materially better than the way that you're working at the moment. Then if we can get that exposure to people, and that can sometimes involve just sending them a video or getting them to a familiarization session, and that then a lot of the objections can fall away. But then lastly, on the encouragement, there's no point going to a busy lawyer and saying we can save you 10 minutes on your transaction if only you learn something new or you're distracted for a moment. If they're really busy, they're only going to adopt things which have a substantial impact on their day-to-day working life. So if you can't provide them with a technology that's going to, you know, save them hours and days rather than a few minutes here or there, then I wouldn't be surprised if they resist changing the way they work. So try and do something substantial. And then, you know, that's all on the carrot side. We have clients want the automated documents to be used to the extent that they remove the Word versions of their precedents from the system as well. So that it's the only place to go. I kind of prefer the encouragement route, where you say, this is materially better, you know, you should be using that. And then track it every month as well. So we report back to clients every month with a report saying, you know, who's using the system, how often have they used it, how long were they in the system, how much time have you saved? Because you'll have bought a technology on an assumed ROI. Actually, you need to track that monthly to make sure you are tracking against your assumptions. And if you're not, then, you know, why is that? What is it that needs to be done to the project in order to encourage further use? So I think that all goes into the mix.
Yeah, a lot of that resonates, you know, with what certainly I see in my role, where in our firm, the way we get adoption is very much about positive reinforcement that the solution is better. It's really hard actually in our business to sort of mandate a change, because ultimately people have a choice, and you can take Word documents away from them, but their choice is just to recreate it and start again. So I think you have to position the change really clearly in the way, through the engagement process, so that people that are adopting it, either clients or partners and lawyers in the business, really understand that it's better for them. And to your point, it makes a material difference to their day rather than just a little bit around the edges. The kind of balance to that, which I always talk to my teams about, is, you know, don't worry if you can't get everybody to adopt it. If you can get most people there, that's a really good start. And from that, you can build the compelling case for the rest of people to adopt, maybe over a slightly slower timeline as well. So I think there's sometimes a perception that if you don't get everybody to adopt something day one, it's failed. And actually, I think if you can get most people to adopt it relatively quickly, that's really positive and gives you a platform to build from. Your point about Amazon's quite interesting. And I use a similar analogy internally with our partners, which is around sort of mobile banking apps, really, which I think everybody uses nowadays. And if people with pretty much no education or tuition actually can start transferring money around the world to different places or whatever it might be, then they're the sorts of principles I think we have to build into the way we present automated document solutions back to lawyers. If that makes sense, they should be as easy to use, as intuitive to use as the mobile banking apps that people pick up every day and do some pretty significant things with. So trying to make sure we get the user interface around the questionnaire. I know we work really hard with your team on the projects we've done to make sure we get that presented in a way that will make sense to a lawyer, not just make sense to somebody that's sitting in an innovation team, for example.
Yeah, I guess that's a necessary design point, isn't it? Because we've got to be realistic about how much training the lawyers are going to attend. It's not that they don't want to attend training sessions, but actually, you know, the number of people that will turn up, if you keep on, you've got to prioritize your training for the lawyers. And actually, if you have a technology that they could, in theory, pick up and use straight away without attending any training, then that's got to be the test, really. If they can't do that, or it's overly technical, then it's just not going to happen, and the adoption's really going to suffer. Just talking more generally about tech partners for Gowling, is there anything, and I'm thinking as a tech provider, but for other tech providers that might be listening to this, what are you guys looking for? What are the good characteristics of a tech partner that Gowling's look for?
We sort of straddle both sides of the fence here a little bit, actually, because we launched a couple of years ago our own tech business called Avail. So we've had to learn about how do we get the clients of Avail to help the clients of Avail adopt that technology as from a sort of a selling side, as well as how do you like to receive pitches and sales information from tech providers. I think for us, it really comes back to taking time to really understand the problems that we're trying to solve. And to your earlier point, being very supportive in helping us work through those to solutions, which may end up actually not involving the technology that we thought it did at the start. Because I do recognize your earlier point about sometimes you don't need an automated document, you just need a good document. And then that might become an automated document at a later date. So I think working with the tech people that really partner with us and invest in understanding our pain points and our client pain points is critically important, actually, and then helping us build those into solutions. And that's certainly the approach we took with the Avail business, alongside getting things like the user interface really simple and making sure what you've got is the helicopter and not the building blocks, if that makes sense. And I think if all of that comes together, then you can have really successful projects with valued partners. And I think if it doesn't, then you end up normally with, you know, less effective projects and therefore relationships that don't stand the test of time, really.
And I didn't think of it like that, but with Avail doing so well, I guess you're pretty uniquely placed in that you're on both sides of the conversation today, aren't you?
We do find ourselves on both sides, but an Avail came out of, you know, an internal innovation that was adding value, and it made sense to share it, really. It wasn't something we set out to do. I'll be honest with you, I wish I could say it was that strategic, but it was something that came out of an innovation project. And I think there is room, actually, across the industry, perhaps facilitated by some of the legal tech businesses, to sort of share some of the innovations that are happening. So there's broader adoption, perhaps more consistent adoption, which helps ultimately clients, because at the end of the day, all of this, the innovations that we make really are about providing better service to clients. And if clients can receive automated documents that might be have lots of different technologies behind them, but it feels very consistent, then that's got to be a good thing from a client's perspective.
When you've kind of undertaken these projects, okay, we covered a bit of this already, but just to go over the points of what a successful project looks like from your perspective, as in what are the key characteristics that, a year in, let's say, to a project you're looking for to tick the box for success?
Well, you know, I remember talking to our head of innovation when we started looking at document automation and saying, how will we measure this? How will we know when we've been successful? And from doing some research, the answer that came back was, you know, we'll measure the number of documents we've automated, which to me didn't really ever feel like the right KPI, actually, because I'd much rather automate one really important document brilliantly and deploy it across 80% of the business than automate 500 documents that won't ever get used. So for us, it is about really understanding the value proposition, the ROI on the particular solution that you're aiming to put in place and making sure that it solves the problem. So we're back to the old hammer analogy again. I think, you know, make sure that the problem's understood, that you've got the right solution. Don't just go looking for something to solve with the piece of technology or the piece of innovation that you happen to have in front of you.
I suppose if you set your target based on number of documents, then you wouldn't be surprised if people go to automate lots of documents irrespective of. One thing we're all always talking about is depth of automation, which is kind of directly correlated to time saved. So if you say to people, you know, you're going to automate 500 documents, 1,000 documents, and there's no other criteria, then they will do just that. But it doesn't mean that you're going to get a return. And certainly you'd be creating a maintenance problem for yourself. So I think that's right. It's got to get down to the financials pretty much straight away, doesn't it? In terms of revisit the business cases as often as you can, and then measure yourself against. Often the business case is there for getting past your desk, Andrew, I'm guessing. And then it's forgotten. It's done its job because the project's been signed off. But actually revisiting that and just your key statistics in terms of, you know, has it had a measurable impact on productivity, recoverability? How are we feeling about risk reduction through use of this technology, which could be, you know, there's other measures other than have we been sued, as it were, on the documents.
It's interesting, the financial aspects actually in lots of these projects are secondary in my view. So, you know, risk mitigation is important. Probably the measure I look at most is client satisfaction. By doing this project and solving this problem, where will it move client satisfaction? How does our client feel about it? And that would be a much more important metric actually than just the pure financial ROI.
That's super interesting.
James, one point we've touched on actually, which it'd be just good just to look at in a bit more detail, is I often hear from my teams that document automation risks sort of detracting from the craft of drafting, and that junior lawyers therefore aren't going to learn the arts of proper document drafting once automation's in place. And I was just interested in how your clients view that.
I do hear that, and I think it's a legitimate concern in that we have to make sure that the junior lawyers rising up the ranks acquire advanced drafting skills, and we definitely don't want to lose that. I think it's more of a conversation around what is it that we're automating and what is it that the technology does. So it's not a black box in that it's a rules-based rather than an AI-based system, and it's following predetermined rules which have an effect on the document. And so when we discuss that actually the automation is taking the routine mechanical aspects of drafting and eradicating those, the technology handles those, and then the freehand drafting and the inspirational lawyerly thought is handled by the attorneys, lawyers at their desk, then we need to talk about examples of that. So if you have a conversation with somebody who has that point and say, well, look, what is the training value in changing the seller is to the sellers are 1,000 times in an M&A suite of documents? Or what's the training value in bringing a rider in and making sure that it works with the rest of the document? Then actually people are a lot more relaxed about the purpose of the automation and allowing it to be used. When I was practicing and supervising lawyers, I used to have a two-step review process. And so the first step would be that a lawyer would take a template document, and they would effectively process that document by solving all of the square brackets, putting the data into the contract and working their way through. And then at the end of that process, they search for the square brackets or the placeholders. And once those are all removed, then some junior lawyers would say, right, I'm done with the document. It's ready to go out. And I would say, no, you've only done step one. Go for a walk around the block, have a cup of tea, step away from the document, and then come back. And now when you come back, I want you to be a lawyer. And now analyze what the client's instructions were and all everything else that you've learned at law school, and then apply that to the document, because all you've done is process the document up to now. And so stage one is what the automation does, and stage two is what you need the lawyers for. Now, in saying that, we need to make sure that the technology is completely transparent. And so the user knows exactly what's happening to a document based on the input. So that might be previewing the document, seeing it changing. It might be through guidance on screen, et cetera. But there needs to be lots of guidance included within the UI to ensure that everybody knows what's going on. And so that's one element. The other is that actually, rather than detracting from the training, we can use document automation as a training tool in itself. A lot of our firms will build scenarios quickly in our technology. So they'll say, in scenario A, this is what the document looks like. Let's just change a few of those parameters. Now in scenario B, look at the compare of the document. You can see exactly what's changed. And you can build those scenarios very, very quickly during a training session so that people get a very quick look around the document and can determine what's going on. So we encourage our clients to use Claralis as a training tool and be very open about what the technology is doing and what it's not doing, to make sure that everybody realizes that it's not taking away the freehand drafting, it's not taking away the advisory aspect, which is really what we pay the lawyers for at the end of the day. It's just the routine and mechanical aspect. So once we have that conversation, it's normally okay.
That resonates loudly, actually. And just to bring it to life with our experience a little bit, we have roles in our business which we call legal engineers. And these are the people actually that would work with Clarilis or on a document automation project or one of our teams directly. And they tend to be normally paralegal type skill sets. And I think what I'm seeing, you know, is a real shift actually in the sorts of skills that the lawyer of the future will need to have, to the extent that knowing about document automation and how to apply it becomes actually quite a valuable skill, quite an important skill. So rather than it detracting from training, in itself it starts to bring value, if that makes sense, both to individuals and to clients if we're trying to keep building distinctive client service. And one of the examples of this that I'm really proud of actually is that two of our legal engineers, and I must give a mention to Seb and John, having learned document automation with us in our innovation teams, have gone on to now secure training contracts with our firm. And I'm convinced as a result they'll become really rounded lawyers actually, because they understand document automation already and they'll learn about the law, which clients will appreciate and get much more value from. And I suspect you'll see more people like that in the future when you look at what the skills that lawyers of the future need to have actually.
Thank you both for having ILTA as part of the conversation. And I look forward to our continued conversations as we finish up the series between your organizations.